Come, come, whoever you are, wanderer, worshipper, lover of leaving, ours is no caravan of despair. Come, yet again come.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Michaela Sievers, and I'm a member here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I sing in the choir, serve on the music committee, and I've grown up in this congregation, and I'm a current student at Kansas State University. And once in a while, like today, I volunteer to convene and guide our Sunday services. We gather here at the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan not because we think we are all the same, but because we are enriched by discovering and celebrating how we each are unique and different. As a liberal spiritual community, we respect and embrace people of all backgrounds and identities. We are a welcoming congregation and strive to be sensitive to issues of social justice. We support those who have suffered injustice and iniquity for reasons such as race, religion, sexuality, gender, and other labels. On that note, today is the annual Transgender Day of Remembrance. Please join me in a moment of mindful silence in honor of those who have lost their lives as a result of transphobia and hate crimes. For the rest of this morning, we are exploring how the Thanksgiving story might be told in various ways and perspectives. I'd like to draw your attention now to the order of service for some announcements. There's a community interfaith Thanksgiving service this evening at 7 p.m. at the First Christian Church. They are accepting donations of cash and non-perishable food items for the Flint Hills Breadbasket. Also, our UU Thanksgiving Soup Luncheon will be next week, the 27th, after the service. It is a potluck, and if you are able to help before, during, or after, please contact Jen Campbell. In a few weeks, on December 4th, everyone is invited to a feedback circle following the service to discuss ideas about the service itself. The family of Ashley, Margot, and William Mitchell will now light our chalice this morning while I read Spirit of the Harvest by Gary Kowalski. Each of us will be grateful this Thanksgiving in different ways, gathered in our separate families, each with our own distinct recipes, customs, and traditions. For some, we'll have pies of mince and others of pumpkin or apple, and some will dine early, and some sit down late to the meal, passing on the wisdom of the elders. As to the question of whether the stuffing should have raisins or currants, and whether to add sage to the gravy, for such differences of opinion make us truly appreciative, realizing that as there is no one right way to celebrate the gifts of life, so there is no wrong way to share in love or friendship. But amid our diversity, let us also be united in our gratitude for a world in which there are many faiths, a nation in which there is freedom of worship, a community in which people of many backgrounds can gather in mutual care and respect. Amen. Our opening hymn is number 349. We gather together in joyful thanksgiving. Please rise and join in singing. As a congregation, We support each other through personal experiences and recognize that by sharing brief yet meaningful stories about our lives, our joys are magnified and sorrows diminish. If you have a brief personal joy or sorrow to share, please raise your hand and wait for the microphone.
Shirley Hobrock, and I was looking for our new member who just joined last week, Shannon Skelton. Right there, I didn't see you come in. Would you stand up so everyone can see you, Shannon?
Good morning, Christopher Renner. I have some sorrowful news. Some of you know a member, a friend of this fellowship, Marion Quinlan. I know she comes to the women's coffee. She's going to be evicted from her home on Tuesday. And so if you are free this afternoon or maybe tomorrow and can lend a hand, for your daughter and I are boxing up her belongings. She was in Indiana visiting her grandchildren and great-grandchildren when the notice came through. And tomorrow I'm going to try to see if there's any way we can avert the eviction, but we need to box up the house so that the movers can take her things. Otherwise, she'll lose all of her personal possessions as well as the home. So if you're free this afternoon, she lives at 2333 Chris Drive, that's sort of south of Sunset Zoo, in that neighborhood there with Ridge Drive back in that area, and we could use some hands.
I just want to say that I am proud of my son. Yesterday he played in his piano recital, and he did a very good job. And so after almost 2 years of playing the piano, he's doing a great job.
For all the joyful stories and sorrows, both told and untold, we hold you in our hearts. Deidre Greeley will now share about guests at your table.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Deidre Greeley, and I'm here to talk to you about this year's Guest at Your Table fundraiser. Guest at Your Table is an annual fundraising and education program that supports Unitarian Universalist Service Committee's human rights work. We invite everyone to take part, individuals, families, small groups, congregations, and even community organizations. This year's Guest at Your Table program theme is Defying Hate, and it's based on the Ken Burns documentary about the UUSC founders, the Sharps, and their movie Defying the Nazis, The Sharps War, that has been shown on PBS. The Sharps defied hate by helping Jews and dissidents escape Nazi Germany using brave, creative methods, many of which could have caused them to be imprisoned, tortured, or killed. UUSC is proud to carry forward the Sharps' legacy by continuing to defy hate and protect the lives and rights of refugees, asylum seekers, and other marginalized groups, both here in the United States and throughout the world. In addition to the Sharps, UUSC will be profiling stories of three other marginalized individuals in our Stories of Hope. Guest at Your Table has been an important part of UUSC and congregational culture for over 40 years. Each year, involvement at Guest at Your Table grows, strengthening UU connections to our shared principles and helping to challenge injustice throughout the world. This year, we will have cans created by our RE children in their RE department to make it more fun for the families. And we'll also have an online donation portal for people regardless of their congregational connections. UU congregations and individuals in the United States and around the world participate in this important annual tradition. We come together. We learn about people directly connected to human rights work. We have the ability to reflect on our own lives and raise funds to advance justice in communities here and abroad. There are several ways that our congregation can help take part in this. The first is to take home a guest at your table can that the RE department is making for us. And it's been suggested on the websites that what you do is you take the can and you put it on your dining table, and every meal you invite someone who is in the Stories of Hope, and we will be kind of rolling those out and introducing you to those stories throughout the month. Or you can find someone online or someone local that you know who's marginalized and in trouble, needs our help, and invite them to your table, think about them, discuss ways that you can help. If you're able to, if you can drop a donation of what that meal would have cost to feed one other person into the can, then that builds your donation over the course of the time. There's another way that you can help, and that's the online portal. It's uusc.org. You can donate directly, and there's even a link that you can link your donation to this congregation. The other way that you can donate is here at the congregation. You can get a donation envelope, and I'll have those out front starting next week at a small guest at your table. And we'll have more information about the different families that have been profiled for this year's Stories of Hope. And the fourth way that you can help is to speak to your employer or another local community group or organization and see if they would like to participate in some charitable giving and help us along the way towards realizing the goals. What I found interesting is that there is a UU congregation at Shelter Rock in Manhasset, New York, who will match any gift of $125 or more. And every donation of $40 or more earns you an annual UUSC membership. So those are ways that you can give and get a little something back. And if it's possible for you or your family to give that $125 gift, then it will be matched by a congregation in New York. So we're going to pick up the cans next Sunday. Our RE groups are making those cans for us today. We'll have a table out front, and we'll kick this off. It goes for 4 weeks. We actually wrap it up on Christmas Day, but if you're not here on Christmas Day, we'll meet the following Sunday afterwards, and we'll kind of wind things up. Let's see. I'll have the donation cards. We'll have more information along the way as it comes available. I have one more quick thing. There's a drop box out in the narthex for the Fit Closet. They are currently asking for winter coats, gloves, extra, extra large size clothing, and other children's clothing. Nothing has to be new. It just has to be clean and in good condition. So there's a drop box out front, and every week I'll pick up anything that's in there, and I'll take it over to the Fit Closet. So thank you guys so much.
Now I invite the children to come forward as Reverend Jonalu tells us the story of the great law of peace.
So, hello. I heard there's a holiday coming up. What is it? What?
Thanksgiving.
Now, what if I told you that some people have lots of Thanksgivings over a course of a year? Do you know that? And that there were lots of Thanksgivings here on this continent before the Europeans came. Did you know that? You did know that. Okay, there's a group called the Haudenosaunee. Okay, Haudenosaunee. Can you say that? Very good. Very good. They're also called the Iroquois. And they're sometimes called the people of the longhouse because they have these houses that look like this. This is the traditional form of housing, and it's really a long house, and they live in those houses, and they make decisions in those houses. They talk together and make decisions. It's five different tribes that came together hundreds and hundreds of years ago. The Mohawk, the Cayuga, the Onondaga, the Seneca, and the Oneida, and then in the 1800s, the Tuscarora joined them. Anyway, in their great law of peace, which I'm going to talk a little bit more about, they recognized a bunch of Thanksgivings. They had a midwinter Thanksgiving and the maple or sugar-making Thanksgiving. They had a raspberry Thanksgiving and a strawberry Thanksgiving. They had a corn-planting Thanksgiving and a corn-hoeing Thanksgiving. I'm not sure I'd want to give thanks for hoeing the corn, but that's okay. They had a little festival of green corn and a great festival of ripe corn. So corn was pretty important, huh? And they had the complete Thanksgiving for the harvest. So, and each nation's festivals were held where? In the longhouse. So they had it in the longhouse. So I want to show you something else. You know what this is? It's a dollar bill. Do you know what's on the back of this dollar bill? Yes, it is a one. It is a $1 bill, because what I'm going to show you is only on the back of the $1 bill. Do you know what this is?
No, it's an eagle.
It's an eagle on the back of the $1 bill. And what does the eagle have in its claws?
Bush.
Okay, it looks a little like, it looks like a bush, but you got it, Nick. It's an olive branch, and what else?
Arrows.
And arrows. Okay, so what do you think that's about? What do you think that symbolizes?
The Mohawk?
Well, it some of it comes from the Mohawks. Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe they make that stuff into bones and arrows.
What?
The olive branch symbolizes peace.
And what do you think? Do you have an idea? Okay, if the olive branch symbolizes peace, what are the arrows?
Freedom.
I think actually it's war and peace. They're holding these together, the war and the peace. And these symbols are some that came from the Haudenosaunee people.
The pyramid.
Well, it doesn't have to do with the pyramids. So there was a guy, Digawadana, who was called the peacemaker. And there are a lot of different stories about how he came to bring peace to the people. And he came from outside, from far away. He was a shaman. Anybody know what a shaman is?
No.
Nick.
Kind of like a priest, but
Native American. Kind of like a priest. Yeah, kind of like a priest. And he came to the mountains and forests of New York in a canoe made of white stone, which I think is quite a great trick. With a message of peace. And though he was really a powerful shaman, he had trouble speaking. He had a speech impediment, a problem with his speech, so it was hard to understand him. But he connected up with somebody else, Iyanwata, who some people call Hiawatha, who was a great speaker of the Onondaga. And together they persuaded the people to make peace. Now, he didn't always need to talk. Once he took a single arrow and what? He broke it, yeah. And then he took five arrows. He had a bundle. Could he break it?
No.
No, with the five arrows all together, he couldn't break it, and nobody else could. So he was showing how if they were united as one people, they would be less able to be snapped in two. And so then he said that they were going to fall into darkness until they banded together. And do you know what happened then? they did band together, but there was a solar eclipse. The sun was blocked out by the moon, and it did become dark, and all these people came together. And he directed the chiefs and the council to sit beneath the shade of the tree and watch the council fire, told them that all issues concerning the people would be discussed and deliberated under the tree. And beneath that tree, the peacemaker asked that all the men lay down their weapons. Jake? Okay, yeah. So they put down their weapons, and they put an eagle up above to see far and wide to alert them to any trouble. And the great law of peace allowed them to make decisions that they would all agree on in consensus, and it created a balance to bring them together and preserve their union and peace among them. And it gave an example to our nation today. And so that they could celebrate their many Thanksgivings and be wise and happy. And so you can go to your classes.
When we combine our talents and resources as a congregation, we can do great works, supporting causes like Guest at Your Table. Your contributions help further the story of our congregation, keeping it alive and thriving, able to pass on and continually rewrite our story of working for social justice and human rights. Please consider that each dollar, each person showing support, and each hour of work aids in our social justice efforts, supporting organizations for human rights, and funding our expenses that keep our fellowship maintained so that we may have a home to gather in. Our contributions do more than any of us know, because we each help rewrite the stories of those in need whom we support. Collectively, your contributions help to write a story for our community, state, nation, and world, of a larger beloved community for all.
Thank you.
Next, I would like to share an adaptation and reflection on Cornbread and Cider Communion in Refugee Times by Don Cooley. The Cornbread and Cider Communion is a tradition in some UU congregations. With gratitude for our freedom and for our abundance, let us celebrate this ritual today, mindful of Syrian and other refugees who are unable to go home, those for whom we pray safe passage and a welcoming reception when they arrive at their destinations. The cornbread is a symbol of home. But what if you suddenly found yourself in a place where everything about the food was different? Imagine what it might be like to flee your homeland and the foods to which you are accustomed and end up somewhere else where you not only don't speak the language, but where even the basic fruits, vegetables, and grains are different. Just as teff is indigenous to the African continent and millet is indigenous to the Asian continent, corn is indigenous to the North American continent. Let us hold in our hearts all those here and abroad who have been forced to leave their homes, for whom home is no longer a place of safety, and for whom home no longer exists. Here, some parallels could possibly be drawn to the Thanksgiving story that most of us are likely to think of as traditional. The European immigrants to America, for example, might share an understanding with modern refugees. Many of them fled their home countries because of persecution and intolerance. They arrived in America finding things they had never experienced before. One such encounter was with the native people. From the native's perspective, however, the Europeans were viewed differently, which is part of what Jonalee will be exploring in her message today. The only apples native to North America are crab apples. The ones we enjoy in this country today come originally from Asia, through the Middle East into Europe, and then on to America. As we share our apple cider this morning, may it symbolize the sweetness that can come from being open to new experiences. Whether it be new foods or new people, let us remember how our lives are enriched when people share their gifts with one another. Please rise and join in singing hymn number 404, What Gift Can We Bring?
In my ministry, a member of the congregation I served was excited about his informal study of the pilgrims and volunteered to write and produce a play about the crossing of the ocean and the settlement of Plymouth, filled with all the struggles, deaths, and hardship they had to overcome. He created it for a Sunday morning service with the children playing the parts. Well, we did it, and boy, what an uproar. The complaints ranged from it being too much of a downer to how women weren't adequately acknowledged to not showing how oppressive the Pilgrims' Calvinist religion was to, and this was the strongest, to how the play didn't include a condemnation of the colonialism of the Pilgrims and how they abused the native people they found on the continent. So, I've been rethinking the Thanksgiving story ever since. With each passing year, my perspective gets bleaker. Warning. At the same time, I try to balance the treatment of the holiday because, frankly, I love Thanksgiving. The giant balloons of the Macy's Day Parade, the marching bands, the huge turkey, the cranberry, the pumpkin pie. Not that I've had a traditional Thanksgiving dinner in years, so maybe I only love the idea of it. And now that it's become the day to race to the mall for the start of Christmas shopping, its appeal has faded. I never liked the day after Thanksgiving shopping fest, focusing on how grotesque our dedication to the god of consumerism has become. All that stuff, all that acquisition, all those crowds, rudeness, and mess. So what do we do with Thanksgiving? I sincerely appreciate the need to say thank you to whom or whatever. I might address those thanks to God, but it's fine to express gratitude to the universe, to the people around you, or simply to feel grateful. Any way you look at it, gratitude is a healthy spiritual exercise. But what about the story? Way too often, the story of the first Thanksgiving is mythologized. A few years back, a woman I knew who had some Cherokee background showed me worksheets her daughter had had to do in preparation for Thanksgiving that outraged her. The mother met with the teacher and complained about the inauthentic costuming of the Wampanoags, the overgeneralizing about Indian life, the distortion of history. It was contrary to everything she was trying to teach her daughter about her native heritage. And the teacher simply didn't get it. Didn't even seem to understand that the history she had been taught and was teaching was more myth than fact. The first Thanksgiving was a misnomer at best. Harvest festivals were common among both the British and the Native Americans, as they have been in agricultural civilizations around the world throughout time. Harvest has always been a good excuse for parties. When people have a harvest, it's a time of celebration. It's probably the most common form of holiday. The Wampanoag, who were the nation who joined the Pilgrims in their festival, celebrated five Thanksgivings of sorts through the year, the harvest being the last. And here's what one of my mentors in ministry, retired Minister Jane Jepka, wrote about the so-called first Thanksgiving. Apparently, Pilgrim Edward Winslow wrote the only eyewitness description of the first Thanksgiving. In his brief letter to a friend in England, Winslow described the joy, the celebration, and the carousing that followed the harvest of 1621. That first to-do seems to have been like harvest home back in England, cakes and ale and hang the cost. Pilgrim Winslow makes no mention of thanks. Uh-oh. We find out that the religious component of Thanksgiving and even the act of giving thanks are later additions. Isn't that the way? Specifically, Alexander Young, a clergyman, while documenting the Pilgrims' early years, added a footnote to the letter of Edward Winslow calling the event the First Thanksgiving. So let's drop back and look from a different perspective at the whole story, as best I can discern it. These relationships are far more complex than we usually think of them, and our historical perspective is limited because the English wrote the histories. The Wampanoag never recorded their version of events, though they have oral histories that others have begun to take into account. Remember how stories contain not only facts, but also the emotional content and the judgments? Remember how we rewrite our stories, even rewire them in our brains? To figure out what may have happened from a non-English perspective, we have to do some detective work and open up our imaginations. until the 1970s, academics gave little attention to the Wampanoag side of the story, thus oversimplifying and reading through a single European lens. And even when white people started realizing that this was one of the starting points of colonization and oppression of Native people, the condemnation tended to be simplistic at first, rather than digging into the motives, feelings, and perspectives of the Wampanoags. Often we think of the Pilgrims as if they were the first Europeans in Massachusetts, or at least in this particular place. Not so. First off, they didn't even call themselves Pilgrims. They called themselves separatists. So, for our purposes this morning, I'll set aside the label of pilgrim, which denotes a religious journey, usually to a sacred place, and returning from it. These people weren't pilgrims, they stayed there. They were settlers. And 6 years before these settlers came, in 1614, Englishman Thomas Hunt had captured people from this very location and sold them as slaves in Spain. Even Captain John Smith, whose own record is not spotless, criticized Hunt's actions. Among the slaves taken was a Patuxet man who took to calling himself Tisquantum, which roughly translates as wrath of God. So we have a small sense of what he might have been feeling. Most of us heard him called Squanto when we learned the story in school. Fluent in English, because he had lived amongst his kidnappers, he would prove himself helpful to the settlers. Tisquantum, with great determination, actually made his way back to his homeland via England and Newfoundland. Now that is a movie I would pay to see. When he got there, he found the once bustling coastline deserted, except by skeletons. Villages of deteriorating homes and untended fields. His own people, the Patuxet, had been wiped out, maybe by leptospirosis, 7-day fever, or hepatitis, some sort of horrible disease that had been acquired from French traders. 90% of the population, not only in Patuxet, but in all the surrounding towns, had died. Imagine figuring out how to get out of slavery and back to your home from Europe in the 17th century only to find your family and all your relatives and friends dead. That tiny sliver of the story is unimaginably painful. Tisquantum must have been devastated. The Mayflower settlers saw the plague as the work of God granting them an uninhabited place to live. Patuxet, the town Tisquantum came from, they renamed Plymouth. In 1623, Cotton Mather, in a Thanksgiving service, praised God for the diseases that had cleared the land for Christian settlement. Throughout this time, colonists marched into towns vacated from disease and took them over. Now, the Wampanoag shared the view that the event was supernatural, though hardly a blessing in their estimation. They were also concerned that the decrease in their population made them vulnerable as a people. The Wampanoags were headed by the sachem or leader, Massasoit, who took in Tisquantum, or should I say, captured him. Massasoit listened to Tisquantum's stories about the English and his advice to ally with them, taking it all with a grain of salt. After the settlers had hung around Patuxet a few months, surviving the winter, Massasoit sent an emissary to them, not Tisquantum. Samoset was not Wampanoag, but he was a guest from up north who had picked up some English from fishermen who visited the coast where he lived, though he was not as fluent as Tisquantum. Only with another translator did Massasoit trust Tisquantum, though. So Samoset checked things out before calling in Tisquantum.
Under Tisquantum's influence, Massasoit did want to negotiate an alliance with these foreigners to protect his people from the neighboring and more flourishing Narragansett, who had not been afflicted with the epidemic. Tisquantum took advantage of his familiarity with English, the language and the people, to gain status and alliance with the newcomers. He helped the settlers to negotiate peace with the Wampanoag Nation and with the related tribe called the Nauset, with whom the community had already had some violent confrontations. And as we all know, translating languages is not all there is to translating cultures. The agreements probably did not carry the same meaning for both parties. Massasoit had his reasons for letting the settlers stay that had nothing to do with being friendly Indians. Then there are the Nauset, related to but not identical to the Wampanoag. You may know the story of how the colonists stole bushels of seed corn from the Nauset. I've seen it cited as 14 bushels or 40 bushels. Anyway, the Naussets had harvested it and buried it to save for planting the following year. And the settlers found it buried across the bay from where they ended up living, and seeing no one guarding it, because from the Nauset perspective, why would you? It was buried, clearly, to protect it. And this incident could explain some of those early run-ins between the two peoples. Arrows and gunshot were exchanged. And besides, the Nauset were still ticked off from the kidnapping stunt a few years earlier. So the story is told that Tisquantum taught the Englishmen how to plant the stolen corn. No wonder tensions continued with the Nauset. They too, though, agreed to peace treaties brokered by Tisquantum with the promise that they would be repaid for their corn. I could not find documentation of whether or not the repayment ever occurred. Different secondary sources report different outcomes, as might be expected. What we call the First Thanksgiving came in the midst of these negotiations. And here's how Charles C. Mann describes it in his book, 1491, New Revelations of the Americas Before Columbus. Massasoit showed up with 90 people, most of them young men with weapons. The pilgrims responded by marching around and firing their guns in a manner intended to convey menace. Gratified, both sides sat down, ate a lot of food, and complained about the Narragansett. Eke Thanksgiving. In time, Tisquantum parlayed his associations into personal advantage, setting parties against one another until caught in his web of deception by both Massasoit and the English themselves. He must have been a quick talker and a valuable asset to the settlers because he managed to retain his life. The temporary peace treaties he secured were another story. Often depicted in the histories we read as a time of great accord and goodwill between the Englishmen and the native tribes, these years actually held tension. Though the Mayflower settlers of Plymouth and the Puritans of Boston Colony were different groups in our eyes, and agreements by one might not be seen as binding on another, the people who lived in the area felt violated as more and more English colonists came taking more and more of the land. And besides that, a smallpox epidemic struck in the 1630s, further weakening the native people. Now, often the mythologized story focuses on the peace treaties without telling of the frustrations of the Wampanoag and Nauset, or the Narragansett and Pequot, for that matter. This sentence is not atypical. Peaceful relations between the pilgrims and Indians had lasted 54 years. Really? What about the 1637 massacre of 700 Pequot people by English soldiers? Originally, the Wampanoag may have befriended the Englishmen to have an alliance that might help them against the Narragansett, though in time they found more in common with their indigenous cousins. It seems to me that the settlers at Patuxet and other colonizers who followed them rationalized these years as peaceful. Had the Wampanoag been as content as the English described, we wouldn't have experienced what happened next. Only a generation after the Mayflower arrived, 50,000 English colonists had settled in Massachusetts and Connecticut. Metacom, also known as King Philip, the second son of Massasoit, had had it and incited a rebellion that's called King Philip's War. The Wampanoag were nearly wiped out during the 11-year fight. By the end of the war, 40% of the Wampanoag had been killed, while others were enslaved and sent to the Caribbean, and some escaped to Canada. Miraculously, a few Wampanoag survive in New England today, mostly Mashpee, related to the Nauset. Not many, only a few. And these details are lost in the fog surrounding that mythical first Thanksgiving. To be fair, the settlers had suffered greatly. Their numbers were decimated by disease and starvation. Without help from Tisquantum and other natives, they would have done so much worse. But they chose to leave Holland, where they already had freedom of religion, and to cross the ocean to take the risk to invade a foreign land, not the way we usually tell the story, but it's a truthful way. The Wampanoag did nothing to invite the decimation that came to them. And this is only a portion of what was suffered by native people. We rarely talk about the string of war against the tribes in the 17th century, the series of three Powhatan Wars in Virginia, the Pequot War in Connecticut, the Dutch Indian War on the Hudson, and the Beaver Wars against the Haudenosaunee. Wars cropped up because these people were being invaded. And this is why some people of Native heritage today call the holiday Thanks-taking. As John Stewart has said, "I celebrated Thanksgiving in an old-fashioned way. I invited everyone in my neighborhood to my house. We had an enormous feast, and then I killed them and took their land." Let's zero in on one of the common symbols. More than once, I've attended Thanksgiving celebrations where a small bundle of 5 kernels of corn was distributed to attendees. It's often described as representing the corn that kept the pilgrims alive. Well, the Nauset likely saw it differently. What would such a bundle represent to them? The bushels of seed corn taken, stolen by the pilgrims. The symbol of the pilgrims' ability to live through the winter represents for Native Americans stolen goods, a foreshadowing of the taking of the continent. Since 1970, United American Indians of New England have gathered on Thanksgiving Day at Plymouth, originally Patuxet, for a national day of mourning. The event was sparked by an invitation to a Wampanoag, Wamsutta Frank James, to speak at a celebration of the 350th anniversary of the Pilgrim's Landing, something he was loath to celebrate. These words come from James' 1970 speech, the first day of mourning, but they remain relevant. "This is a time of celebration for you, celebrating an anniversary of a beginning for the white man in America, a time of looking back, of reflection. It is with a heavy heart that I look back upon what happened to my people. What has happened in the last 300 years? History gives us facts, and there were atrocities. There were broken promises. And most of these centered around land ownership. And so down through the years, there is record after record of Indian lands taken and in token reservations set up for him upon which to live. The Indian, having been stripped of his power, could only stand by and watch while the white man took his land and used it for his personal gain. Our spirit refuses to die. Yesterday we walked the woodland paths and sandy trails. Today we must walk the macadam highways and roads. We are uniting. We're standing not in our wigwams, but in your concrete tent. We stand tall and proud, and before too many moons pass, we'll right the wrongs we have allowed to happen to us." So, what do we do once we recognize that there's another story besides the myth learned from childhood? First, we have to recognize that stories have real consequences. The myth of the celebratory feast shared by pilgrims and Indians has distorted our history and minimized the European invasion of this continent. We have a responsibility to correct the story, to tell a new story, a truer story. And what does this retelling mean for those of us who are white? I struggle with this. I know from the multicultural studies that I've done that it's not healthy or helpful to be in a place where I react against my own culture and try to embrace someone else's in its stead. I can't just set aside who I am, where I've come from. So the only thing that leaves is trying to reshape my own culture to be more honest, more open, and more in keeping with the values I profess. Thanksgiving is part of my culture. I grew up with it. My family celebrates it. And as I said earlier, though many of its manifestations make me uncomfortable, I still love a good parade. How then can I reshape Thanksgiving? Hold on to its qualities of agricultural festival, particularly in a rural place like Kansas, but let go of the colonialist values attached to it. How do I confess that I have profited from the exploitation of others, and how do I begin to mend those broken relationships? I don't pretend I can answer these questions easily, but I have to ask them. I also have to recognize that at the core, at the heart of the holiday of Thanksgiving, when I strip away foolish stories, is the practice of gratitude. This regular late November national holiday did not come into being until the sad days of the Civil War, when it was most needed. Thankfulness remains an essential human spiritual practice. If I'm ungrateful, then I'm most likely to continue the practice of taking what does not belong to me and misusing what does. I have to understand that what looks like gifts to me must be treated carefully, with a sense of stewardship rather than ownership, that I need to leave gifts for those who come after me, that I never take anything for granted. Perfecting gratitude awakens me to a humble life and a happy one. And at this point, I would invite your reflections, thoughts, questions, discussion. And I'll bet there's a mic that can come around somewhere.
Colina Stanton. Yesterday I was at the farmer's market and ran into a woman that had been one of my clients. And she's Native American. I have learned a lot from her. And she feels strongly that the symbol of Indian for the high school is inappropriate for all the things you're saying, that Native Americans are not dirty, they're not warlike, they are the same as everybody. And I'd like us to think about that at this time.
Yeah, it's all connected, isn't it? It's all connected.
I'm Jim Chanteau. Mm-hmm. My daughter, Karen, was in the Peace Corps in Guatemala in 1992, the 500th anniversary of Columbus' discovery of America, or actually the Caribbean area. And she said in the indigenous regions of Guatemala, course, they don't celebrate Columbus arriving. In fact, it's a day of the dead. It was the end of their culture, the start of the end of their culture anyway. And I remember hearing that when she told me about the time. I mean, this is quite a few years ago now. And, you know, that's the other point of view. Mm-hmm. People were living here, mm-hmm. and they were discovered.
Christopher Renner, my take on this is something different. Mm-hmm. As I left Christianity and I saw Christmas as being more and more a commercialization of a Christian holiday, I really sort of embraced Thanksgiving as an alternative. Mm-hmm. In Italy, all the 17 years I was there, my Thanksgivings became quite famous amongst my Italian friends. People would call reserve a year ahead to come to the next Thanksgiving. And it was a time to gather friends together and to be thankful for what we had. Mm-hmm. And so that's sort of how I look at the holiday. I know there's a lot of cultural packaging that we have to look at, and I am thankful that in my classes we didn't have the pilgrims and Indians and that kind of stuff. I taught more content about the idea and its ancient roots, because mm-hmm. some of these roots of the celebration actually go back to pre-Christian times mm-hmm. in Western mm-hmm. Europe. And so that's sort of how I embrace it. And being aware of the cultural baggage that comes along, I think, is always time for discussion around the table and try to enlighten mm-hmm. people. But I really sort of embrace it as a non-Christian event. And I think that's what I like about it.
And I think you've followed through the process that's exactly what I'd recommend. You know, that process of what do I retain and hold on to from this thing that my culture has bequeathed to me, and what do I have to strip away and let go of. And but I think it's important, though, that we reflect on what is the story, what has been the story, and what do we do with that? Yeah. So thanks. Yeah.
Pat Embers, just a piece of information. Yesterday and the day before, I watched the whole video of 500 Nations, which I think is at the library. I bought it, but I hadn't seen it yet, and I watched it. Was really like everything you said today in terms of the mythology that we view about Thanksgiving is about the whole Indian culture, you know. And it was very clear in this film, and it was moderated. It had a moderator, but like a narrator, but then they interviewed, there were a lot of Native American people that spoke up about these things that happened, and they were of the Narragansett and the Haudenosaunee and the different ones. And I just would like to recommend that as a film. I mean, it spoke to me the whole time, and this is like a follow-up mm-hmm. of that. Mm-hmm. So I thank you for that mm-hmm. with us.
Yeah, and the book 1491, I think, is a good one to look at, too, if you're looking for resources.
Diane Barker. You know, in the work that Pat and I have done with Flint Hills Wisdom Keepers and getting to know elders from across the country and various tribes, I think the biggest loss for the invading people who tell a myth about themselves as being pioneers and settlers is that they didn't stop and consider or learn the social structure. The bands and the tribes lived by consensus, which is a much harder thing to do than democracy, where democracy leaves some people feeling like winners and some feeling like losers. And this is not an easy thing to achieve, consensus. And I think as we go forward, that's what we ought to concentrate on. And I happen to bring this book in. One of the things about consensus living is that you all agree to conform to certain modes of behavior. And, you know, truth would be the foundation there. And they didn't have prisons because if you couldn't conform, you were ostracized. You know, that means a completely different thing. Here in America, where people believe in individuality and anonymity, if you're ostracized, you just go somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And, you know, kind of like the Catholic priest issue. Mm-hmm. You know, they could go someplace else and misbehave there. There was a different consequence for the Native people. You would probably die. You'd have a very hard time surviving. And so the elders that we know, that Pat and I know, you know, they don't want to go backwards.
Right.
They want to go forward. And I think what we have lost is the geniality, the love, and the sense of family that consensus brings.
Yeah, and consensus is very hard. Very hard. And it's a different way of thinking. I often think if we spent as much time and energy studying how we could have peace as we spend studying how we can have war, then it would be astounding what we would be able to accomplish. So, yeah.
I'm Ann Marchin. I'm a member of one of the Chalice Circles, and we just mm-hmm. discussed on Thursday about stories. And one of the handouts that they recommended as reading, it was a book by Thomas King, a Native American man, The Truth About Stories. And it's a very interesting book, kind of a modern perspective. But he pointed out that when the people in Boston were rebelling against the English for the Boston Tea Party, they dressed as Indians. And that maybe there was kind of a secret understanding of that these people were noble and honorable and believed in liberty, and then that's why they disguised themselves that way. I thought that was an interesting.
Or maybe they wanted to blame it on somebody else.
Just thinking about the different ways that Thanksgiving can be celebrated and how it means different things to everybody kind of made me think about how when I was growing up, Thanksgiving was the holiday that the two halves of my family that didn't get along would broker a temporary truce and we'd have an alliance and sit across from each other at the table. And it was mostly peaceable. And it was the one time a year for that. And then now, as I have my own tradition. We, you know, a lot of people do Friendsgiving, where mm-hmm. it's you celebrate with friends that are like family, and it's come to be a much more peaceful tradition for me than it used to be. But I guess that's just something I enjoy about it. But.
Yeah, I think creating our own traditions around the holidays is really significant.
We try to do this practice every night around the dinner table. We say our gratefuls.
Yeah, there, people are having... like a rock star.
We've, in our family around the dinner table, we try to do this each night. We say our gratefuls. I guess, you know, we every day these days, it's so easy to be taken up in the negative. Mm-hmm. And we find that this has really been a really good practice for us. And I also learned recently that we have some Iroquois blood in our family. And I've always been interested in how the Indians did governance. And I think I agree that we stand to learn a lot from that practice as well.
Yeah, gratitude, I think, is a really important practice. And I think gratitude is one of the things that can get us through some really difficult times, looking at What am I truly thankful for? Even if it's just the sight of a little flower on the prairie, or even if it's seeing the sun come up, or having somebody you love near you, those are important things to acknowledge and know are part of our lives. And that's what can save us in hard times. That's probably why Thanksgiving became a holiday during the Civil War. Well, let me close this with words of Percival Chubb. From the harvest of the soil, we are given occasion to garner a harvest of the heart and mind, a harvest of resolve to be careful stewards of all life's gifts and opportunities, a harvest of reverence for the wondrous power and life at work in things that grow and in the soul, a harvest of gratitude for every good which we enjoy, and a fellowship for all who are sustained by earth's beauty. And so let us join in reflection on that beauty in hymn number 21, For the Beauty of the Earth, Rise in Body or Spirit. I leave you with the words of Barbara Peskin. Because of those who came before, we are. In spite of their failings, we believe. Because of and in spite of the horizons of their vision, we too dream. Let us go remembering to praise, to live in the moment, to love mightily, to bow to the mystery.